It is Tuesday, January 12th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we will preview President Obama's final State of the Union address. We will talk to a U.S. senator and get his assessment on North Korea's recent nuclear test. We'll also take you to a village in Syria where people have been starving to death. And we will look at the life and career of British rock star David Bowie, who has died at the age of 69. It's all ahead on International Edition. It is his final State of the Union address, and President Barack Obama says that he wants to lay out an optimistic vision for the United States, not just for his remaining months in office, but for years to come. VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey has more on what the American public can expect from their commander-in-chief during Tuesday's speech.
Since I took office 7 years ago in the midst of crisis, I don't think I have ever been more optimistic about a year ahead than I am right now.
It's this optimism, not just for 2016, but also for the years ahead, that White House officials say will be showcased when President Obama addresses the nation in his last State of the Union message on Tuesday. Unlike last year, when Obama laid out specific proposals, including providing free community college tuition and bolstering cybersecurity, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest says this year, the president will focus on his long-term outlook for the country and also counter the pessimism heard in the presidential campaigns and reflected in public opinion polls.
And so much of the rhetoric that we hear from the other side is focused on fearing the future and being anxious and insecure about a changing world. The fact is, the United States is better positioned than any other nation in the world to capitalize on the opportunities that lie ahead for us.
That does not mean the president will not take time in his address to point out what he has accomplished since taking office in 2009, as he laid out in his most recent weekly address.
Our businesses are now on a 70-month streak of job creation, with more than 14 million new jobs in all. We've revamped our schools and the way we pay for college. We've made historic investments in clean energy and put ourselves on a path to a low-carbon future.
On the global front, Obama will likely showcase his recent diplomatic successes in normalizing ties with Cuba, reaching a nuclear agreement with Iran, and working out a deal on climate change. But George Washington University professor Matthew Dalek says Obama also will likely address the ongoing challenge of terrorism and the fight against the Islamic State militant group.
A defense of his record on ISIS and also maybe a critique of the idea that we can simply send in U.S. ground troops back into Iraq and into Syria to solve this problem, or that you can simply bomb your way out of the problem.
Despite the public's concerns about national security, White House officials say the president has never been more confident in the country's capability to confront challenges, a message Obama will deliver to the American people directly on Tuesday. Aru Pandey, VOA News, the White House.
It's time for a check on what is trending online, and International Edition social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here to do just that. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So I understand another name has been thrown into the mix for the U.S. presidential race, as if we didn't have enough names already, huh?
That's correct. Yet another name thrown to the crowded mix. CNN reported Monday that former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is considering running for the Oval Office. The report says he commissioned a poll to see how well he would do as a third-party candidate against Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. The CNN Politics Facebook page shared the article.
Okay, and what did the article say about the findings of that internal poll?
Well, the source who spoke with CNN apparently didn't say, but guess who had a lot to say on Facebook? The readers. The first person to comment wrote this: Bloomberg is as much of a liar as Clinton. He knew he couldn't win as a mayor in NYC, as a Democrat after 9/11, and the strong leadership of Giuliani, then quickly changed parties once elected. His words cannot be trusted. The second comment was also negative towards Bloomberg. It reads like this: ridiculous. He wouldn't have a chance. All anyone outside of New York knows about him is that he likes to control people's lives by telling them what they should eat and drink. He's a control freak.
So is that reader making a reference to Mayor Bloomberg's ban on sodas?
Absolutely. So let me briefly explain for our international listeners. While in office, Bloomberg introduced the sugary drinks portion cap rule. The regulation put a limit on the size of soda drinks in New York City to dissuade people from drinking too much soda. And I also want to add that in addition to serving as New York City mayor for three consecutive terms, he also built a financial data and media empire, Bloomberg LB. Now, as for supportive comments, which were hard to find, by the way, here's one. I've been praying for this. He was a fabulous mayor. Mayor of NYC is the second hardest position in the country. Even if he can't win as a third-party candidate, Trump would be defeated and we'd be saved.
So there's at least one voter who sees Bloomberg as a potential savior.
Mm-hmm.
So what did Bloomberg himself have to say about this CNN article on Twitter? Did he say anything at all?
Absolutely nothing as of yet. His two tweets Monday are about British rock icon David Bowie and climate change. He's on Twitter at Mike Bloomberg and actively retweets from the numerous Bloomberg accounts. Michael?
Well, thank you, G, for bringing us the latest social media buzz. You can follow G on Twitter at G Abby Lee. That's spelled J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This program is on Twitter as well. We are at VOA underscore IE, and you can find me as well. I am at Michael underscore Lippin. We'd like to tell you that VOA coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address to the nation will begin at 0200 Universal Time on Wednesday, that is Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Washington time. The two-hour program will feature VOA anchor Mil Arcega, as well as VOA senior political analyst Jim Malone and our congressional correspondents Cindy Sain and Michael Bowman. This is VOA.
Green Beat. For a healthier planet.
Tasmanian devils are in danger, and not the kind that comes from Looney Tunes.
What's up?
The real Tasmanian devil is being threatened by a rare contagious cancer that has killed up to 90% of the wild population in some parts of the Australian state of Tasmania. While breeding programs try to bring back their numbers, conservationists are using high-tech gadgetry to keep disease-free devils from falling victim to another problem.
Some of these little populations only have two or three mums breeding now, and if two or three of those get hit by a car, that's it.
David Pemberton manages the Save the Devil program. He says a virtual fence that alerts wildlife to approaching vehicles has shown promising results.
Well, the section of road without the virtual fence, there were four devils run over. The other section, there were none.
When a signpost detects approaching headlights, it sets off an alarm and begins flashing lights, keeping Tasmanian devils and other wildlife from trying to cross the road. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. The U.S. House of Representatives has held a debate on a bill called the North Korea Sanctions Enforcement Act, which seeks to deny the Pyongyang government the hard currency it needs for its nuclear weapons program. A vote is expected in the House this week, possibly as early as Tuesday. Meanwhile, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee received a classified briefing late Monday on North Korea's most recent nuclear test. One member of that committee, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, spoke exclusively on Monday to VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Bowman asked Senator Kaine ahead of that briefing what the senator hoped to get out of it.
Well, I want to get the as much information as I can about what we think the explosion was. You know, I know that the original claim was it was a hydrogen weapon, but there's been significant reports suggesting that it really wasn't the level of seismic and other activity. But part of it is, what do we know? But part of it, I think all of the committee members are going to be asking questions about what we're going to do and what other nations are going to do, especially nations like China that have, you know, we don't necessarily have all that much leverage with North Korea since we don't have a normalized relationship with them. But there are other nations that are allies of North Korea, and I'm interested to hear what they're doing to try to exercise their influence to check North Korean behavior.
There does seem to be this idea that whether or not it was an actual hydrogen explosion, that the U.S. policy and the broader international community's policy towards North Korea has been lacking in some fashion. Any thoughts on that?
Well, look, in the 1990s, the U.S. and the global community tried to stop North Korea from getting nuclear weapons, and that failed in the 1990s. The IAEA was doing inspections and was not able to detect North Korean cheating. And that led to a wholesale change in IAEA policies and the development of the additional protocol to make sure that there was inspections that would be robust enough to determine cheating, detect cheating. And that was a real positive move that the IAEA, but the global community let North Korea get over the nuclear threshold in the 1990s. So it's no surprise, I mean, that they're doing this. Because that was, I think, pretty clear 15 or 20 years ago that they were crossing the threshold. But we just have to decide, you know, what we can do together with allies like Japan and South Korea to check this threat and also demand that nations that do have close relationship with North Korea, especially China, are exercising their influence to do the same.
When you're talking about a country that's that isolated, in the end, is there any pressure that can be leveraged?
It's hard for the U.S. to do it because we have, you know, no relations whatsoever. I mean, you know, again, having diplomatic ties gives you leverage. If you have no ties, you lack leverage. But there are nations that still have ties, and understanding, you know, what they're doing and demanding that they do more is important.
Just switching gears slightly.
Yeah.
Are you expecting to hear from President Obama any sort of update on the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal, especially given some of the recent actions mm-hmm. undertaken by Iran?
I was actually in Vienna with the IAEA last week to talk about this very thing, and together with members of the Foreign Relations Committee. You know, I wrote a letter with Chairman Corker and others as soon as the missile test happened in October, to basically say, I think this is a violation of UN Security Council resolution. And we went to the IAEA, a number of senators and I, to talk to them about what they're doing. So yeah, we definitely expect to hear from the White House tomorrow about that. Because look, I'm a strong supporter of the deal, but the deal only works if there's tough implementation. And that includes not only on the four corners of the deal, but in other areas that are subject to international law. If Iran sort of cheats and they get away with it, then that will likely affect how they treat this deal. We got to make sure that everybody understands that we're going to implement with a degree of immediacy and firmness.
And that was U.S. Senator Tim Kaine speaking with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Aid has finally reached the Syrian rebel-held town of Madaya, where reports say residents have been starving to death after months of a blockade by Syrian government forces and their Hezbollah militant allies. Henry Ridgewell spoke to one activist whose relatives are stranded in the besieged settlement and brings us this report.
After 6 months under siege, help finally arrived Monday for the desperate people of Madaya. Red Crescent trucks carrying food and medicines were escorted by United Nations vehicles as part of a deal between government and opposition forces. The relief came as further evidence emerged of the suffering endured by young and old, men and women. The deal to deliver aid is welcome, but not enough, says London-based activist Fadar Jassem, whose grandparents, aunts and uncles are stranded in Madaya.
They're cold, they're starving, they're exhausted, and they just want to get out. You know, I mean, we welcome the news that aid has finally been able to get in today, but we're told these aid packages are only last for up to a month.
Speaking after a meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah in Washington, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said full access to Madaya must be allowed.
That's what we agreed on in the ISSG meeting in New York and the U.N. Security Council. And we're raising it with all parties right now. We're pressing for it very hard. It has to happen.
Syrian government forces and their Hezbollah allies deny blockading Madaya and accuse rebel forces of preventing anyone from leaving the town. That's simply false, says Jassem.
They have been starving people. It's a systematic and dirty war tactic, you know, that they've been using for over 2 years now in Syria. You know, Madaya isn't the first place this has been happening.
Under the deal to allow aid in, another convoy delivered food and medicine to two Shiite villages in Idlib province, which the government claims are under siege from rebel forces, a charge they in turn deny. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Mexican Attorney General's office says the extradition process is underway to send Sinaloa drug cartel kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman to the United States following his recapture on Friday. But Guzman's attorney has vowed a tough legal fight to keep his client in Mexico. Mark Jones of Rice University in Texas says it is the American consumer's insatiable demand for illicit drugs that enriches cartels like Sinaloa. And Jones tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that Guzman's rearrest in Mexico was just a matter of time.
Because of his ties to Mexico, as well as his support base in Mexico, he really couldn't flee abroad. So he was in some ways trapped within Mexico and had to constantly stay ahead of a Mexican government, which had some U.S. help in trying to evade police. And eventually he was caught, in part due to his own hubris of wanting to have this biopic made, similar to, I guess he's been watching Narcos on Netflix about Pablo Escobar, and he wanted to have a similar biopic about himself.
Was it just the height of arrogance on his part that he would allow this meeting to take place?
I think it was a combination of arrogance, and perhaps it could also have been due to the realization that either sooner or later he was going to be arrested, and therefore he wanted to be able to get this done while he was still free and able to have more time on his hands and more flexibility and more influence over the overall process.
What is the likelihood now that he'll be extradited to the U.S.?
Oh, it's now extremely likely that he'll be extradited. Now, prior to his previous escape, the Mexican government effectively told the United States that it wasn't going to happen because extradition to the United States would be seen as a blow to Mexican sovereignty and something that would injure Mexican national pride. They simply refused to do it. However, the Peña Nieto government realizes that it was unable to keep him in jail in the most recent escape from El Altiplano. And then, of course, under a different government, he had escaped as well. And at this point, I think Peña Nieto realizes that the political fallout from a third escape far outweighs the cost from extraditing him from Mexico to the United States. So I would expect the Peña Nieto government to try to get Guzman out of Mexico as soon as possible. Clearly, though, following the letter of the law and all manners of recourse within Mexican law.
Well, Mark, despite his recapture, his Sinaloa drug cartel continues to live on.
Despite his capture, the cartel will continue to live on. But if he is extradited, his ability to control the cartel will vanish. That is, during his previous incarceration and following his escape, he was able to direct the cartel through various intermediaries. And so even when he was in the Mexican maximum security prison of El Altiplano, he had easy access to way intermediaries as well as cell phones to get to the rest of his cartel and effectively run it from inside.
And that was Mark Jones of Rice University in Texas speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
You may have heard that dying people have some rather amazing dreams or visions in the final weeks and days of their lives. A new study by researchers at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, suggests that these end-of-life dreams are an important and comforting part of the dying process that improve quality of life for those about to die. While some in the medical community consider these dreams and visions to be no more than delusions or hallucinations, the researchers found that to someone dying, they're quite realistic and often very meaningful. The researchers found that the most common and most comforting theme of these visions and dreams were those of deceased family and friends. The study also showed that these dreams and visions became more frequent the closer a person came to death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. The uncertainty about China's stock markets has led many people to believe its economy is fragile and about to break. Not so, say experts living and working inside China. Jeff Towson is the author of One Minute China. Earlier, he spoke to my colleague Jim Stevenson from Beijing and described how the continued push toward urbanization is changing domestic buying patterns in China.
If everyone's out in the countryside, you can't have factories. I mean, you can't have business services. You can't have tech coming. And so that is kind of the starting point. But it turns out, you know, it's really interesting. People are, you know, we're social creatures. You put us together and we change each other. So as soon as you put consumers in an urban environment in China, their buying patterns change. They start to buy like Europeans and Americans, you know, coffee and brands. And it appears to shift fundamentally once they go urban. You also see the GDP per capita start to increase rapidly.
When you have people clustered together like that, you have more people who are able to buy goods and services trading. You have people going to school, all the money. It really feeds into these other trends.
Now, I think that's a China phenomenon more, because if you look at cities in, say, Latin America, you don't necessarily see that. You see a lot of congestion, a lot of people living in dense cities. You don't necessarily see this rising GDP per capita. In China, if you look, you know, hundreds of cities you can look across, you see that. I mean, urbanization is part of that equation, but there's a lot more going on there. So, you know, a lot of interesting stuff happens when you get people into cities. You start to see specialization. Certain cities are all technology people. Certain cities are manufacturing expertise now. Shanghai's a finance city. You know, you're starting to see like the Hollywood of China, the Silicon Valley of China. So as they urbanize, you know, it's not all just generic cities. You see lots of sort of unique characteristics. Some cities we know that, you know, people spend twice as much on food and dining as another city, you know, 100 miles away. There's funny demographics.
And as you mentioned, it's more a country of clusters as opposed to just one big place.
Yeah, this was really, I think, a big insight. When you keep adding people to a city, it's not just going to get bigger. You know, it's not like you're going to have some megapolis like out of Blade Runner or something. There's different ways you can go. You can have lots of little cities. You can have one mega city. And what China appears to be developing as is basically a series of 20 to 30 clusters where you have these regions with one major city like Shanghai. And then you have maybe 20, 30, 50 smaller cities all linked into it. And the Chinese government has been pretty open about this, that they see, you know, 70, 80% of the Chinese GDP is going to be within these 20 clusters. And each one will be about the same as a European country. So, I mean, that's really how China looks today. Now, you know, maybe in the future you'll see more of sort of a more integrated continental economy like the United States. But right now it's almost like islands in this massive geography. It's a fun way to think about it. I think it gets you closer to the truth.
And that was Jeff Towson, author of One Minute China, speaking to International Edition's Jim Stevenson. This is VOA. Rock fans are mourning British superstar David Bowie, whose death was announced Monday after an 18-month battle with cancer. My colleague Susan Yaki talked about David Bowie's life and career earlier with Ray McDonald.
Joining us here from our music division is Ray McDonald. Welcome, Ray.
Hi, Susan.
Well, this is big, big news, and he's such a diverse guy. Do you take on the challenge of giving him a description?
It's really hard to do, especially in the time that we have. David Bowie was a chameleon. A decade before Madonna perfected the formula for pop music, he changed personas the way other people change their outfits. He started out as Ziggy Stardust, the pop alien. From there, he went on to the Thin White Duke during his soul period. He worked with Brian Eno in Berlin in the late 70s, producing a trio of very influential albums. And later on, he would dabble in dance music for his huge hit Let's Dance with Nile Rodgers. He's done hard rock. His latest album, Black Star, which just came out last Friday on his 69th birthday, was influenced by jazz and hip-hop, according to his producer, Tony Visconti. So he had a hand in everything.
And his producer was saying that this last album that just came out, it's kind of David Bowie's gift to his fans.
That's exactly right, and I think he desperately wanted it out. before he passed away. He had been struggling with cancer for the past 18 months. The news did not get out. I'm assuming that no one outside his family and closest friends knew about it. And I think that the timing of Black Star was very fortuitous. This was his parting gift.
The neat thing about him was that it covers all the ages. Young people liked him. People my age liked him. And he's got fans everywhere.
His appeal is universal. He appeals to the outsider in all of us. Bowie said that he adopted all of these stage persona because he was so unsure of himself. He thought that he himself was a pretty boring guy, that no one would really want to see him speak or perform. So he put on all of these disguises for us.
Yes, he was kind of a fashion icon with all his different designs that he used and characters.
Yeah, his influence touched the world of fashion, the world of music, the world of literature, theater.
Yeah, he was doing a play off-Broadway.
Lazarus, yeah. He's acted in many movies. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, The Man Who Fell to Earth is an iconic movie. Pretty much everything he touched has become iconic. That's the range of his influence.
And even though he was married to a beautiful and very famous model, he's a pretty private guy.
He was extremely private. After a heart attack in 2004... he basically disappeared for 10 years. He was at home with his family, tending to his business, nursing his health. And then in 2013, he released his first album in a decade, The Next Day. And that touched off his latest artistic renaissance. And his most two recent albums, The Next Day and Black Star, are among his very best.
And he was only 69 years old.
Yes, he was.
We don't think of that as being old these days. Well, thank you so much for stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you so much, Susan.
And that was David Bowie's Let's Dance, one of my favorite 80s songs and one of his biggest ever hits in the U.S. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter. The engineer was Chaz Hall. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. You can find me on Twitter at @Michael_Lippin. And you can always tweet to this show as well. We are at @VOA_IE. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The peaceful conduct and high turnout in the first round of presidential and parliamentary elections in the Central African Republic are clear signs that Central Africans seek a new beginning for their country and a future based on democratic governance and free from the violence and instability that have plagued the country for far too long. The United States commends all Central Africans who, with support from international forces, ensured the vote on December 30 was peaceful and secure. As the Central African Republic moves towards the second round of elections in the coming weeks, we reiterate our desire to see this spirit of peace, tolerance, and free expression. And we strongly urge all parties and their supporters to peacefully address any disputes regarding the recent announcement of results through the Central African legal system. These elections are an historic opportunity for Central Africans to build a united, prosperous, and democratic future for their country and establish a government that reflects the country's rich geographic, ethnic, and religious diversity. In that effort, they will find a steadfast supporter in the United States. The United States stands with the Central African Republic at this critical moment and will continue to be a strong friend and ally of the Central African people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.